Okay, can everyone hear me okay? Just want to start off again saying that I'm very honored and very happy to be here in Australia and have a chance to share with you some of the knowledge of history and origin of nations and other aspects of biblical prophecy with you. And to talk a little bit about in the first lecture, what I went through in the first lecture, of course, was the purpose. Why Israel? Why did God call Israel? Why did God create the nation of Israel? And what is God's purpose? Is it God play favorites? Or is God more concerned about the people of Israel than of all other nations? And this is not quite the... I was wondering, actually, with the light, it's very difficult for me to read in the dark, if somebody could... put the lights back on again. Thank you. Well, I want to start out and preface what I'm saying, and I want to. This is a central theme in what I want to talk about throughout this and tomorrow's lecture. Is that Genesis 1:26 is a good place to start, where all humanity was made in God's image. God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." All of humanity, regardless of their race, regardless whether you're African, Asian, European, Aboriginal, Indian, Native American, all of humanity is made in the image of God. And God does not play favorites among races, nationalities, tribes. And there are a few scriptures that I think are very important in discussing this subject to put things into the proper context. Because there are many people who talk about the origin of nations and unfortunately put a racist and particularly anti-Semitic twist on it and sometimes display an attitude of superiority or even disdain towards other races and other... Now, what does the Bible say? Discussing this question, keep these scriptures in mind. Acts 10:34, the Apostle Peter... God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcomed him. In every nation. Acts 17:26, the Apostle Paul was in Athens. The Apostle Paul decried, talking about all of humanity. He made them from one blood, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. Having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God. And in Colossians 3:11, Paul again wrote, there should be no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and freeman. But Christ is all and in all. Now this is interesting, because here you have certain classifications of humanity, as it were. You have... between Greek and Jew, of course, the Jewish people Paul is talking about, and the Greeks who included the Romans, so the Mediterranean peoples. Some in this room may be of Italian descent or of Hellenic background, and they had a very special purpose to play in God's plan, the Greeks in particular in preserving the New Testament. Barbarian and Scythian. The Scythians, he talks about the Jew and the Scythian being one in Christ, and the Scythians... as we'll see, we're a blue-eyed, blonde-haired, what you describe as a Nordic people. What God is saying is that there is no spiritual distinction in God's sight between the so-called Aryans. There's no such thing as an Aryan race. Aryan was a group of languages. There's no such thing between... there's no distinction in God's sight, in essence, between Anglo-Saxons and Jews. And Italians and other peoples. They are all one in Jesus Christ. We are all sons of Noah and sons of God. And so, in the same scriptures, of course, Paul is saying God rises and determines the fall of nations. What I covered in the first lecture, the idea that God determines the course of nations and that God has not only given the United States and Britain, but other nations an opportunity at world power. There was first Egypt, then Assyria, then Babylonia, as Mr. Rhodes was covering this morning, then Medo-Persia, then the Greeks, then the Romans, then the Byzantines, then the Persians, then India, then the Arabs. God made some tremendous national promises to Abraham. Some of those promises were passed on to Ishmael. And the Arabs, God promised national greatness to Ishmael, to the Arabs. Genesis chapter 17. You can look it up, go home and look it up after I'm done, jot it down. Made promises to Esau as well. And the promises to Ishmael were fulfilled in the Arabs. The Arabs became a great nation, a giant superpower of 400 million people. In the days of the Prophet Muhammad and afterwards, the Arabs dominated the world. They were the most prosperous people in the world. They were the most powerful people in the world. They ruled all the way from Spain to the borders of China. And then the Turks, many of the Turkish people are descendants of Esau. And the Turks inherited the promises, certain promises to Abraham through Esau. And what you find, of course, the Ottoman Empire. After the Arabs, you had the Age of Turkey. And Turkey dominated, again, an enormous empire from the footsteps of India and China all the way up into Europe. Turkish army had invaded Europe and even reached the gates of Vienna. After that, Spain, China had a period of world domination. The Chinese were far ahead of the rest of the world in technology. China in the 14th century had a magnificent navy. There's a wonderful book called When China Ruled the Seas. It's written. It talks about the fleet of Admiral Cheng Ho in the end of the Middle Ages. China was producing more iron and steel than Britain was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution during the Middle Ages. The Chinese Navy was voyaging all the way from China to Africa. China was on the verge of world power in the 1400s. They were far more advanced. They had gunpowder. They had thousands. You could go to Beijing, or you could go to Hangzhou, the other cities of China. Some of them were over a million people. This was in the Middle Ages. And China was printing, you could find thousands of printed books in China. China had gunpowder. They had rockets. The reason the Western world was able to advance was that China's technology was passed to the West. And the West was able to progress on the basis of what China had developed over the centuries. Unfortunately, the bureaucratic system that China eventually had an emperor who discouraged Chinese expansion. China turned inward on herself. And that's when the Western world overtook China. But God gave China her period of world power, as he had given it to India, as he had given it to the other powers, and then it passed to Spain. And then the 16th century was the age of Spain, the 17th century and 18th century the age of France, and the 19th century the age of Britain, and the 20th century the age of America. So we see God determining the course of nations and giving all nations, or most nations, or at least many nations, the opportunity for world power, and shall we say world dominion, to see what they would do. And every nation has produced both good fruits and bad in what they have done. So that's what I covered in the first lecture, plus a little bit of the promises to Abraham. The promise that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph would father a nation and a company of nations. That they would be fruitful, that they would inherit the choice places of the earth, that they would have political and military power. And the Jewish people have never fulfilled these promises. They have never fulfilled these promises. The Jewish people have only been one nation of 3 million people compared to the Arabs, who had 400 million. The Arabs were a superpower, the Turks were a superpower, but the main promises of national greatness and national power that were given to Abraham were passed on to Isaac, and then, like, it was the major part of the inheritance. Some of you do real estate and property law and estate planning, and you're familiar with the idea of estate and inheritance. And the major part of Abraham's estate was to go pass from Abraham to Isaac, not to Ishmael, but to Isaac. God blessed Ishmael. But the implication is that Isaac would receive a larger portion passed on to Jacob. Jacob was to receive a larger portion than Esau. But when you look at the Arabs and the Turks, enormous, impressive superpowers. So the nations descended from Jacob would then by logic, by pure logic, by pure common sense, would they not be more powerful, richer, more expansive than even those superpowers? Not to diminish from the greatness of those other nations. And that's pretty well what I covered in the first lecture, plus a little bit of a survey of Israel's history. In this lecture, what I want to look at is what happened to the peoples of Israel after they sort of disappear from history in 720 BC. Now, when I talk about Israel, there's always a certain amount of confusion. One of the reasons why people become confused and do not understand history or where Israel is today is because they confuse Israel and they assume that all Israelites are Jews. They assume that all the people of Israel. This is a map of the 12 tribes of Israel in ancient times. Now, who, of course, was Israel? That was the family of Jacob. And Jacob had fathered 12 children. Jacob's name, you read in Genesis 35, was changed to Israel. So when we read about Israel, we mean Jacob. And Jacob fathered a family or a nation of 12 tribes or 12 clans. There was Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, Naphtali, Benjamin, Asher, Gad, Joseph, and Joseph was two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. These are the 12 tribes of Israel. Judah, who became the ancestor of the Jewish people, was only one of those tribes. Those 12 tribes, of course, coming from Egypt, migrated into the Promised Land, into the land of Palestine. And eventually you had a nation of Israel. The nation of Israel was composed of those 12 tribes. You had, there was, of course, we talk about the Jewish people. The name Jew is merely an abbreviation for Judah. And you had the tribe of Judah settled in the south. And the tribe of Benjamin just north of that. And the tribe of Levi. The Levites were scattered among the cities. But you also had, here was Ephraim. Ephraim promised to be a multitude or company of nations. Manasseh promised to be a great single nation. And then the other tribes, Reuben, Gad, Zebulun, Naphtali, throughout the kingdom. What you can see here, part of this is in red. After the death of King Solomon, the kingdom of Israel, this united kingdom, as it were, under the dynasty of David, around 1000 BC, 900 BC, split in two. And the part you see in red remained as the house of Judah, remained loyal to the crown, as it were. The northern 10 tribes rebelled against the crown. In effect, set up their own version of their own monarchy under King Jeroboam. They had their own religion. And you had two kingdoms. You had the pink kingdom was the house of Judah in the south, and the kingdom of the north, the house of Israel. So keep this in mind. Any history book on Old Testament Israel, ancient times, any Bible commentary will tell you about the house of Israel and the house of Judah were two separate kingdoms. Like Australia and New Zealand are two separate kingdoms. United States and Canada, two separate kingdoms. House of Israel and house of Judah. Judah had a succession of good and bad kings. Israel and one dynasty, the house of David. Unfortunately, the kingdom of Israel had 19 kings, 200 years. The history of the kingdom of Israel was as long as the history of the Commonwealth of Australia. It had 19 kings, but as Arnold Schwarzenegger said, they were all bad. 19 kings, most of them were corrupt. Most of them rejected the temple in Jerusalem. They set up their own religion, which mixed the worship of God with paganism. They created their own festivals. They created their own national religion, as it was, a very nationalistic religion designed to distinguish themselves from the kingdom of Judah. And eventually, this kingdom of the north went further and further into idolatry. The rich got rich, the poor got poorer, and the kingdom collapsed in political and anarchy, ruin, and captivity. and the ancient Assyrians, who were the primary warrior peoples of the ancient Near East. The ancient Assyrians came down around after 750 BC in several ways and took the northern tribes captive. The southern kingdom of Judah remained. But the Bible says in 1 Kings 17, it says that, "Therefore God was angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only," of course, including Benjamin and Levi. But that whole northern kingdom, you're looking at perhaps 3-4 million people. How do we know this? Possibly as many as 10 million people. The Bible in 1 and 2 Chronicles says that King David had an army of 1.5 million men. Now that's the men of military age. You multiply that by about 4 or 5, you would get the entire population. So that indicates that this was not some tiny little tribe of people in the outback. This was a fairly populous nation. This was a nation of perhaps 7, 8, maybe even 10, maybe even 15 million people. And this huge nation was taken captive in waves, one after another. What became of them? What's interesting, of course, the Jewish people of today, by and large, the specialists in Jew, I remember a book, Finding Our Fathers, A Guide to Jewish Genealogy, and I myself am of Jewish ancestry. The name Lewis, I'm a descendant of the tribe of Levi. And this book, Finding Our Fathers, I forget who the author is, Guide to Jewish Genealogy, says the Jewish people of today are the descendants of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. The other tribes, Reuben, Simeon, Ephraim, Manasseh, Gad, Asher, have disappeared. Must be annihilated, must have been gone, but and are today no longer Jewish. In other words, they admit that the Jewish people of today, other than a few families, now there are a few families of the 10 tribes among the Jewish people, but the Jewish people are basically the only known, visible survivors of Israel. The others are lost. They've lost their identity. It's like, but not all Jews were Israel. It's just like not all Tasmanians are Australians, or all Queenslanders are Australians, but not all Australians are Queenslanders, not all Australians are Tasmanians. All Jews were Israelites, generally, although Judaism adopted many converts, because the Jewish people are also a cultural group, like you have the black Jews, the Falashes of Ethiopia, and for them Judaism is a religion. But all Jews are Israelites, essentially, but not all Israelites are Jews. That's the point I want to make. With those 10 tribes, of course, Israel was taken captive in waves. One of the reasons, what a lot of historians will try to tell you, or not try to tell you, but a lot of historians believe, is they look at the evidence and they say that the 10 tribes were never taken captive, the 10 tribes were never lost. And they will point to the fact of one king, Sargon, saying he deported 27,000 people from Samaria. That's the capital. And that's, he says, that's the only record we have of deportation. 27,000 people taken captive. The rest of them stayed there and are among the Jewish people today. That's a very popular argument that some historians believe. However, if we look in context, we look at what the Bible says, we look at what archaeology says, we'll see that Israel was taken captive over a period of decades. It took 50 years to remove the population of Israel. The Assyrian kings came down little by little. 733 BC, Tiglath-Pileser invaded Israel. In his own annals, he says, all the land of Naphtali, the house of Bet-Kumri, that's the land of Israel, all of its people I took captive. He took many, the entire tribe of Naphtali, many from the tribes of Zebulun and Issachar, and everything east of the Reubenites, the Gadites, the half-tribe of Manasseh, everything east of the Jordan, he deported, 733 B.C. What was left was a puppet government, something like that of Vichy France, in Manasseh, Ephraim, and some of the other tribes here. They lasted for about a decade longer, but they refused to pay tribute to Assyria. They rebelled against the Assyrian king. And then the next Assyrian king, Shalmaneser V, this was 726 BC, Shalmaneser came down, marched through the land of Israel and besieged Samaria. And the Israelites put up quite a fight. They put up quite a fight. It took them 3 years. Samaria was like a virtual, like a Gibraltar. It was a virtually impregnable fortress from the Israelite point of view. It took the Assyrians 3 years, Shalmaneser, 3 years to capture Samaria. In the meantime, Shalmaneser deported much of the population, not all of it, but much of the population from the Ephraimite plain, Manasseh, Ephraim, these other tribes. Took Samaria in 723 B.C. We have no records, though. Interesting enough, Shalmaneser left no annals because he died shortly after that. You see, some of the Assyrian kings were very short-lived at this time, so they could not record all of the deportations. And so one of the major deportations of Israel was not recorded simply because Shalmaneser died. And his successor, Sargon, started reigning about 720, 722. Sargon came down, actually took Samaria again because it was a bit of a rebellion. He deported only 27,000 people from Samaria. There were only 27,000 people left in Samaria. A lot of Israel was gone. And then his successor, Sennacherib, came down and invaded Judah and actually took 200,000 people captive from Judah. So there were elements of Judah and Benjamin that went into captivity with the 10 tribes. And we'll find them in Europe today. Now, in other words, Israelites still remained. It's interesting, we see some biblical evidence of this. When King Hezekiah, Judah had a wicked king named Ahaz. And Ahaz died, and Hezekiah then began his sole reign as king of Judah. And Hezekiah, God gave his last warning, to the lost 10 tribes, is recorded in the book of Chronicles. And it says that this was a letter that Hezekiah wrote to, the remainder of the people, so a lot of people remaining in the territory of Israel. And he warned us about 715 B.C., for if you return to the Lord, your brothers and your sons will find compassion before those who led them captive and will return to this land. The couriers passed from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh, and as far as Zebulun, but they laughed them to scorn and mocked them. See, that was the attitude of most. There was a small remnant that went south to join the Jews, but most of Israel, most of the tribes of the people of Israel that were left, even though they had suffered this terrible captivity, most of them still were so set in their ways, did not want anything to do with Judah's religion. They preferred their mixed idolatry, their paganism. They preferred their own way of life. And they laughed at the king of Judah. And this was, in effect, Israel's last chance. But it says that some men of Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. Now, shortly after this, around 714, 715 B.C., this is a map of the Assyrian Empire. Can everyone make out the pink areas on the map? This area, Hala, Habor, by the river of Gozan, and the cities of Assyria itself, and the cities of the Medes. That's where the Bible says Israel was taken. Shortly after Hezekiah's Passover, Sargon moved his armies. Sargon, the Assyrians were fighting a two-front war. They were trying to conquer Egypt. They were fighting on this front. They were fighting on this front. And Sargon moved his armies to the east. And he subjugated the Medes. He subjugated the peoples in this area. Depopulated their cities. And then, at that point, removed another massive wave of Israelites from the land of Ephraim and Manasseh and settled them hundreds of miles. Here we have hundreds of miles away, settled them in the area of Iran and Media. Israel was driven out and never returned. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah, they will mention the Jewish people coming back into captivity 150 years later because the Babylonians had taken them captive. About a century after Israel was taken captive, Judah was taken captive, and the Jewish people were taken down here. This is a long distance from Israel was here, taken to Assyria and Media. Judah was taken here to Babylon. There were hundreds of miles between Israel and Judah. Plus the fact, as we'll see, much of Israel was to have been removed from the Near East by the time Judah went captive. Plus the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. You can read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which were written about 450 BC. And the essential, it talks about Judah, Benjamin, and Levi, the genealogies. It mentions a few families. It mentions there was an element of the 10 tribes among the Jews. Just as you have, let's say, Greek or Italian people in Australia today. They are represented here, but that does not make Australia a Greek or an Italian or a Jewish or a German nation, because you have people of other nationalities who are new Australians. In the same way, there were members of Ephraim and Manasseh in among the Jewish people, but they do not constitute the 10 tribes. They're only a few refugees from the 10 tribes. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah in the Old Testament clearly refer to Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. The far more populous house of Israel is not mentioned. They are gone. How's my time, by the way? I've got 20 minutes. Okay, what I basically want to look at is around the fringes of the around the time and place that Israel was taken captive, a mysterious people called the Cimmerians or Sumerians appear. And these Sumerians appear at the, and two other peoples, the Sumerians, then you have the Scythians who appeared a little bit further to the north. At the very time and place that Israel was taken captive, and these Cimmerians, there was a Danish historian by the name of Anne Christensen. She wrote for the Danish Academy of Royal Sciences, a respectable historian. And she admits these Cimmerians are none other than the lost tribes of Israel, taken captive by the Assyrians. They were horsemen, they were cavalry, drafted into the Assyrian army. Now it's interesting, in the Bible, Hosea 14:3, Assyria will not save us. We will not ride on horses. And when Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, advanced on Jerusalem, he made an offer to one of his officers, to the Jewish people, saying, I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on. This is Isaiah 36:8. In other words, here's evidence from the Bible of Israelites drafted into the Assyrian army as cavalry. And this is exactly what we find with the Cimmerians. The name the Cimmerians called themselves, Gimri, or the Assyrians called them the Gimra, the Humri, Gimra, which came from Bet. What the Assyrians called Israel was the land of the house of Amri, or Bet-Gumri, or Bet-Kumri. Well, this people called Gimri, or Cimmerians, preserved that name. It's interesting that one Assyrian, the Assyrian annals describe these people, they are the offspring of outcasts. And the first place, actually, see what some of the Greek historians in any history book will try to tell you, started up here and came down, and they came down and migrated this way and this way, and that's what the ancient Greek historians said. But you go back to the original eyewitness sources. The first Assyrian annals, the first time these people appear in history is at the very time and place of Israel's captivity. Now, these people migrated westward, settled in Cappadocia. And what we find, a people in this very area of Cappadocia in Asia Minor called the White Syrians. And here's what the Greek writers say about them, and Roman writers, Strabo, the geographer. They are still today called White Syrians, while those this side of the Taurus, that is on this side, are called Syrians. As compared with those this side of the Taurus, those outside have a tanned complexion, while this side do not, and for this reason receive the term, the appellation white. In other words, you had a people called the White Syrians here, one of the very areas that the Cimmerians settled in. And you had these people here were also called Syrians. But what's interesting, you see here that Syria was a designation which in those days included Palestine. The white Syrians were none other than the lost Israelites. And Herodotus, the Greek geographer, noted, the Syrians of Palestine learned circumcision from the Egyptians. The Syrians of the valleys of the Thermodon, up in this area, learned it lately from the Colchians. And besides Egyptians, these Syrians and these Syrians and maybe one or two other peoples were the only ones who practiced circumcision. Okay, what about the Scythians? There was a Persian king by the name of Darius who had an inscription called the Behistun Rock, or the Behistun inscription. And that Behistun inscription, it was written in both Babylonian and in Persian. And the Babylonian term Gimara, that is these people here we're talking about, was translated as Sakka or Sake or Scythian, implying that the Cimmerians and the Scythians were the same people. Now, we've already shown the Cimmerians were Israel. Cimmerians were Israelites. And if the Cimmerians and Scythians, or some of the Scythians, were the same people, therefore you would find an Israelite element amongst the Scythians, who eventually moved up into the Ukraine. And, of course, one of the names the Scythians called themselves was the Sakai, or Sakai Sona, sons of Sakai, which Israel called itself the House of Isaac, sons of Isaac. I'm having to move pretty quickly. You have an apocryphal writing, Jewish tradition. A lot of the Jews of the Caucasus of southern Russia claimed ancestry from the 10 tribes. There was an apocryphal writing, a book of Esdras, written around the time of Christ, talking about the 10 tribes taken captive from their own land into exile. And it says that they formed this plan for themselves, that they would leave the multitude of nations and go to a more distant region where no human being had ever lived. They went in by the narrow passage of the Euphrates River. Through that region, there was a long way to go, a journey of a year and a half, and that country is called Arzareth, or Sereth. Essentially, some of the Israelites, when the Assyrian Empire collapsed, moved up through the passage of the Euphrates, moved up into southern Russia, and there's a river in Romania called the Sereth, or Sereth River. Okay, migrations to Europe, of course. We've established the Cimmerians were Israelites. Cimmerians were recognized by many historians as the ancestors of the Celtic peoples, the peoples of France, the peoples of Celtic Britain. And what we have, of course, as a quote, Samuel Lysias, historian. Many of the classical writers like Diodorus and Plutarch identified the Cimmerians with the Cimbri or Cimbri in northwestern Europe. And the Welsh, to this day, call themselves Cymry. Like you have the Welsh Nationalist Party, it's called the Plaid Cymru. Cymru was the Assyrian name for ancient Israel. Very same name among the Welsh Nationalist Party of today. And what you see here, of course, is a trail of horse bits. Some of them in Armenia, some of them moving up into southern Russia, but a big trail of them moving up the Danube into Europe. Samuel Lysias, who was an English historian of the 19th century. The Cimmerians seem to be the same people as the Gauls and Celts under a different name. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. The first inhabitants were Britons who came from Armenia and first peopled Britain southward. Lysias also wrote, and this man was not a British Israelite, did not believe the British were Israel. He wrote, I confess that before the universal tradition, which assigns our descent to Japheth, I should have been rather inclined to attribute to the British Celts a Semitic origin, both on account of the relics of worship which we find in Britain, and also on account of the language, the traces of which may still be... And then he goes on talking about this. But the important thing was, he wondered, because the customs and traditions of the Celtic peoples of Britain were so similar to that of the Palestine, the ancient Near East, is it possible that they could be the same people? Okay, there were other... How am I doing for time? about 10 minutes. Okay, the other thing I wanted to mention was that the other group, the Scythians, became the ancestors of the Anglo-Saxons, the term Scythian. The Scythians had been in southern Russia and Armenia, and there was an area called Sakasina here, moving up with the emerging Saka, and there was an Iranian-speaking people known as the Sakai or the Scythians. And these people migrated westward and eventually became the ancestors of the Angles and Saxons. Sharon Turner, who was an English historian of the 19th century, the Saxons were a Scythian tribe. And of the various Scythian nations, the Sakai or Sakai are the people from whom the descent of the Saxons may be inferred with the least violation of probability. Sakai Sunna, or the sons of Sakai, abbreviated into Saxon, which is the same sound as Saxon, seems a reasonable etymology of the word Saxon. William Camden said it seems most probable that which makes the Saxons descend from the Sakai, and to be called quasi-Saxons, or sons of the Sakai. So there were several historians before Darwin and his theory of evolution caused people to reject the inspiration of the Bible. It was a common belief that the Sakai, or Scythians, were the ancestors of the Scandinavian and Anglo-Saxon peoples. As for the identity of the 12 tribes, I wanted to cover that in more detail. I may get a chance to do that in tomorrow's lecture. As to the various identities of the tribes, what I wanted to cover was essentially the nations descended from Israel. Again, the Celtic and Anglo-Saxon peoples. Make this short in a nutshell. What you had here, of course, was Reuben, unstable as water. The excellency of dignity was France. Dan was Ireland, southern Ireland. Naphtali would be found in Scandinavia among Denmark and Sweden. Zebulun, a haven for ships, is the Netherlands. One of the tribes that settled in the Netherlands was known as the Zabuloni, which is derived from Zebulun. Asher are the French-speaking Walloons and part of Champagne, the Eburones. Heber, or Eber, was one of the sons of Asher, and you found a people known as the Eburones among the French-speaking Walloons. With Reuben, what's very interesting is that there was a river in the territory of ancient Reuben known as the Arnon River, A-R-N-O-N. The only other place in the world where you find an Arnon River, it's a tributary of the Loire right in the heart of France. And Issachar is likely partly in Friesland, partly in Flanders, partly Issachar and Zebulun received their blessing together among the Dutch people. Hopefully I can explain this a little more tomorrow. And part of Finland, maybe Issachar as well. Benjamin settled partly in Norway. The symbol of Benjamin was the wolf. And you found a people called the Varini, who had a symbol of the wolf. And with them were a people called the Udoses, or Jutes, who settled in Denmark and eventually settled in Kent in England. What's interesting, the anthropologist Ripley, he wrote a book called Races of Europe, and he looked at the people of Kent in England, and he said, these people look Jewish. He said, these are an Anglo-Saxon people living down in the very southern corner of England. And he said, these people look Jewish, and I do not know why. And of course, Gad is likely Switzerland. The Bible talks about Gad being a troop, like an army, a militia. And while other nations were a country with an army, Switzerland was an army with a country. Switzerland, there's universal military training in Switzerland. The Swiss, like the Israelis, have a citizen army. Very democratic country. They'll have direct democracy in Switzerland. So all these portions of Switzerland are Gad. And of course, this leaves Ephraim and Manasseh. Essentially, Ephraim was to be the great company of nations. You see that in the British Commonwealth of Nations. And Manasseh was to be the great single nation. There were certain portions of Britain, East Anglia, which contributed very heavily to the immigration to the New World, and parts of Scotland, where Manasseh had settled. And Manasseh, the great single nation, was to be the United States of America. And perhaps tomorrow I can go into a little bit of the comparative history of the United States, and more so with the United States because Mr. Rhodes will be covering Britain. both American and English history sort of contained in a nutshell in Genesis 48, the promise to Manasseh. He shall also be a nation, and he also shall become great. See, the United States, after 1800, when God began to raise the Anglo-Saxons to world power, Manasseh became a nation first. Britain was the number one world power. He should become a nation. But then later, in the 20th century, Manasseh would become great. While Ephraim, it says, he shall become greater. The first part of that verse, well, in the 19th century, Britain was the world power. But then it's only later on, Britain started out as an empire. But it's only later on in the 1920s and 1930s that Ephraim became a multitude or company of nations. You have the Statute of Westminster in 1931, where Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Ireland, many of the other nations in the empire, but especially Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, had independent foreign policy. They were, in effect, sovereign nations. The only such company of nations that ever existed in the world, joined solely by the British throne, by the throne of David. So there you have, in a nutshell, the history of the English-speaking peoples in the last 200 years contained in those promises to both Ephraim and Manasseh. The name Manasseh means forgetfulness. God caused me to forget my sorrow in my father's house. Well, the Americans have always been a people who rejected Europe. They are a liberal nation. Americans are that part of the English-speaking peoples who basically like to turn their back on Europe. They're isolationists. The idea of a new beginning. They had a revolution. Well, the name Ephraim, one of the translations for Ephraim means restored or restoration. The right hand was on Ephraim. Ephraim, the British, traditionally, historically, more conservative, an aristocratic nation. The name Ephraim means restored. And what happened with Britain? England tried having a republic. England tried having a republic, but in 1661, the monarchy was restored. The British, the Australians, the Canadians, at least the English Canadians, prefer to preserve tradition. And you find that this difference in character between the two peoples, they are brother peoples, they have the same common law derived from ancient Israel, but with the Commonwealth countries, there is much more of a desire to preserve continuity and tradition than you have in the United States of America. Although, as I will try to point out tomorrow, there are parts of the United States that may even be descended from Ephraim, particularly in some parts of the American South. Essentially, what I essentially believe is that the Puritan New England stock is one half tribe of Manasseh, but the other half tribe of Manasseh could well be the German Americans, because you have America's a melting pot of many different nations. But you find the two largest ethnic groups that founded the United States were the Anglo-Saxons and Scots on the one hand, and the German Americans who came from Southwest Germany on the other. I think I'm running over time, and I'm sorry I couldn't get through this enormous wealth of material. I could only give the broadest overview, but I'll try and wrap some more of this up tomorrow. Yes, yes. According to tradition, the Stone of Destiny, of course, this has been a very heated issue between England and Scotland to this very day. Quite recently, the Stone of Scone was returned to Scotland. Legend and tradition has it that the Stone of Scone, you can read in the Bible about a stone that Jacob laid his head on when he received many of the promises. And the Irish and Scottish traditions hold that this stone was carried by the Israelites in the wilderness, and that it was brought to Ireland by the prophet Jeremiah. It was after Judah fell. The tradition has it that the stone was brought to Ireland along with the princesses of King Zedekiah, who married into the Irish royal family. And from that line of thousands of, there were scores of Irish kings, literally, and I believe about the 600s, the kings of Argyllshire in Scotland descended the kings of Scotland, and ultimately the Stuarts, descended from, and as well the Bourbons and the House of Orange and the House of Hanover and many of the royal lines of Europe are descended, if not from David, from Judah. But the Stone of Stone, when King Edward, I don't know how many of you saw the movie Braveheart, where England and Scotland fought some, like the wars between Israel and Judah. You had Edward Longshanks in England, you had Sir William Wallace as the leader of the Scottish Patriots, and it was like Israel and Judah fighting. And some people have even seen the American Civil War as an extension of the wars between England and Scotland, because there's a lot of Scottish people of Scottish descent in the American South. It was a war between Celt and Anglo-Saxon, according to one Southern historian. But the Stone of Stone, Jacob's Pillar Stone, was one of the best books on this. And of course, it's the origin of the Stone of Stone is still debated, depending on who you read. But Adam Rutherford, one of the best British Israel books that was ever written, was a book called Israel Britain, or Anglo-Saxon Israel, by Adam Rutherford. And it was a British Israelite book. It was very good. It was written in the 1930s. And he presents evidence there that the Stone of Stone did not come from Scotland originally, but had its origin in Palestine. And it's really been like a symbol of the birthright. And from 1295, I believe, it was carried from Scotland to England, was placed, it was in the coronation chair under which Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth was crowned, the kings of England were crowned. The Stone of Stone was there, and at one time it was assigned Jacob's Pillar Stone. Just recently, the Stone of Stone was returned to Scotland. And you begin to see there's a movement toward devolution and a movement toward Scotland becoming more independent. There was the Scottish National Party among many of the Celtic peoples of Europe. The Celtic peoples, you see a growing movement for their sovereignty and independence. Like in Quebec, you have the Parti Québécois, you have the Breton separatists in France. And there is the Scottish National Party. Scotland now has her own assembly. And the Plaid Cymru in Wales. And the Stone of Scone is now back in Scotland. And the Scots are proud to have it. It has a very deep meaning for them. What was that? Yeah, well, it's already been removed. Yes. Well, the English don't take the origin of the stone very seriously, so I don't think it's a much more emotional issue with the Scots.
Okay, that's one more question.
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Nice short answer. We're sort of on time, but we can be running behind time. So, ladies and gentlemen, will you please join me to thank Dr. Lewis for his presentation?
If you're like me, you'll figure it's not worth the effort to get up for 2 minutes, but hey. Also, while you're stretching, I'll just remind you that the order form for The Lost 10 Tribes in Prophecy, a free booklet, is at the information table. You can fill that out, and a copy will be sent to you in a couple of months when it becomes available. The quote is particularly interesting because it was written in 1940 when Great Britain was fighting for its very survival against Nazi Germany, but over 1 year before the United States entered the war. But 1940, keep the year in mind. The book is called The British Empire, 1784 to 1939, and was written by American historian James Truslow Adams. And this is what he wrote as recently as 1940. In this great crisis, we in America have a great stake. We know that stability is impossible without respect for law and order, for the honesty of the written and spoken word. Without liberty of thought, speech, and press, progress is impossible. What these things mean to the world of today and tomorrow have been amply demonstrated by the negation of them in certain great nations during the past few years. Different peoples may have different ideals of government, But for those who have been accustomed to freedom of person and of spirit, the possible overthrow of the British Empire would be a catastrophe scarcely thinkable. Not only would it leave a vacuum over a quarter of the globe, which all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression would rush, but the strongest bulwark outside ourselves, outside the United States, for our own safety and freedom, would have been destroyed. Until 1940, the multitude of nations, the British Empire and Commonwealth, was America's front line of defense, as well as the power, the force, that preserved basic freedoms for much of humanity. How the world has changed in the 60 years since that book was written. Now, Cicero was the ancient Roman philosopher who lived from 160 to 43 BC, during a time of great turmoil, which led eventually to the collapse of the Roman Republic. And he said this, "Not to know what happened before you were born is to be a child all of your life." There's a great deal of truth in that, because when people don't know their history, they're going to make immature decisions. We live in a democracy, all of us, whether it be Australia, Britain, the United States, Canada. And if people are exercising their vote without a knowledge of history, then inevitably they're going to make immature decisions. Cicero was right. He knew, because he was living at the end of the Roman Republic, which finally collapsed and was replaced by a much more despotic empire. The title of this second lecture is The Multitude of Nations, the Free World's First Line of Defense. If you turn with me, if you have a Bible, to Genesis 35, I just want to quickly recap on some of the scriptures, some of which have already been quoted by David. Genesis 35, verse 11. God said here to Jacob, "I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of you, and kings shall come out of your loins." A nation and a company of nations was prophesied. Chapter 48 of Genesis, in verse 19, where Jacob is placing his hands upon his grandchildren's heads and kind of seems to get them the wrong way round, giving Manasseh, the oldest one, the second blessing, and Ephraim, the youngest one, the first. And normally it would have been the other way around. But Jacob, when his son told him, "You got the wrong son," said, "I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people," talking about Manasseh, who was to become the United States. "He also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations." Because most people alive today have lived through a period of American domination of the world, unless people are at least, 55, 60, they don't remember a time when the world was dominated by the multitude of nations. Because of this, many people today think the United States is the most powerful nation in history, but it has not been. Almost immediately, the United States became the major power at the end of World War II and had its own atomic weapons. The Soviet Union got its own atomic weapons, and we had the Cold War for most of the last 50 years. So the power which the United States had was never equal in relative terms to the power that the British Empire had. Hence the term Pax Britannica, the period between the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 and the beginning of World War I in 1914, that 100-year period where the British peace was maintained throughout the world. Genesis chapter 49 prophesies that Joseph would be spreading everywhere at the time of the end. Joseph, the father of both the British and American peoples. Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a wall, whose branches run over the wall. There's also an interesting verse after that. The archers have surely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. A reference to how many conflicts have been fought in order to preserve the freedoms of the nations which are the Western democracies today. Genesis chapter 12, another prophecy here that shows that Abraham's descendants were to be a blessing. The Lord had said, "Abraham, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. The dual prophecy, the spiritual blessing of Jesus Christ, who had come to save the world, but also the physical prophecy regarding the physical descendants of Abraham, and how they would be a blessing in the world as well. And it's interesting, having lived in Africa for so many years, I can tell you that this is a basic economic law, that nations that bless the United States and Britain receive blessings in return. Nations that curse the United States and Britain suffer as a consequence. And you can look anywhere in the world and you'll see that that is very much the case. Chapter 17 of Genesis. We see something interesting here. Again, just looking at these scriptures rather quickly here. In verse 4, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. Many nations were given birth to by the country that was referred to as the mother of parliaments. In this, here in Genesis 17, it's the father of many nations. Chapter 22 and verse 17 is also an interesting scripture in this context, Genesis 22 and verse 17. In blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. Talking about the strategic locations that the descendants of Abraham would have, which enabled them to have this period of world domination. Some of those strategic locations are Gibraltar. I can get my light here. Gibraltar up there at the end of Spain. You've got Malta right in the Mediterranean. Cyprus further along. You know, the Suez Canal just there. Aden further down. You know, so Britain was able to control the passage of trade and people all the way to the east. Of course, India was very strategic. Just there was British as well. Singapore just there. The Cape of Good Hope around South Africa. Again, controlling all the traffic around there. Strategic islands in the Caribbean. America had the Panama Canal, or does have until December 31st. Then it loses the Panama Canal. As David showed, these scriptures have not been fulfilled in any other nations. They've only been fulfilled in the nations that we're talking about. During the period 1775 to 1815, which was a 40-year period, and the number 40, as you know, in the Bible has great significance. During this 40-year period, the world changed dramatically. Prior to 1775, around 1760, the French and Indian Wars had been fought in North America between the British and the French, with various Indian tribes taking different sides. George Washington at that time was in the British Army, and he is the man who is credited with triggering off the first skirmish, which in effect started the First World War, because that was the first time that a war was being fought all over the world by two powers, Britain and France. Britain won and ended up dominating North America, but only for a few years, because a few years later then the United States had a revolution and the British lost the American colonies and were left with Canada. So in this 40-year period, a number of things happened. Ephraim and Manasseh were separated. The tribe of Joseph was divided between Ephraim, that was to become a multitude of nations, the British Commonwealth, and Manasseh, which was to be a single nation, the United States of America. A later war between the two nations, the War of 1812-1814, still in this 40-year period, contributed to two further developments. I've often gone to Niagara Falls because I live only 5 hours away from it. And when we have visitors, I take them there. And not only are the falls a sight that I love to see, but it's also an area of great historical interest, because much of the fighting in the American-British War of 1812-14 was fought around that area. It's also interesting, the actual Battle of Niagara resulted in 1,800 and something British dead and 1,800 and something American dead. It was equal on both sides. The Americans thought when they went to war with Britain that as soon as they crossed into Canada, the Canadians would rally around the Americans, because the Canadians were an oppressed colonial people. But they learned when they crossed that the Canadians would rather have been within the British Empire than in the United States. So Canada made it clear that it wanted to continue under the crown, thereby starting the process that led to the development of the British Commonwealth, the multitude of nations. But also the United States fully realized, because it was able to hold its own against Britain, even though the city of Washington, D.C. was burned down. You know, the White House was destroyed. A lot of people in the last 12 months were asking me if I could arrange some sort of a landing party to do the same thing again. But the United States fully realized it was an independent nation separate from the mother country from which it had broken away 40 years before. The third thing that happened was that Reuben, or France, moved into second place, or even lower, in the world league table of nations. And another thing that happened was that Britain acquired more colonies as a result of defeating France, changing the nature of the empire, which until that time had been mostly a collection of trading posts around the world. But it changed significantly after the war with Napoleon. So that period of 1775 to 1815 saw all these changes, the creation, the birth of the United States of America, and Britain becoming the supreme power in the world. The American Revolution is interesting in the development of the British Empire because the loss of the American colonies led to the development of what historians call the Second Empire. Australia in particular owes its origins to the loss of British colonies in North America, because Britain had to look elsewhere to send its convicts. And, you know, as all Australians know, that was very much a part of the early days of Australia. But also during that war, the American Revolution, the British learned an important lesson, a lesson in what we might call real politic, that you can only rule over a people with their consent, and that you must rule over them in ways which the subject peoples clearly see as beneficial to themselves. It's a major lesson for Britain. Thirdly, it's interesting because it should never have happened. There was a series on PBS, which is the American ABC, a couple of years ago on the American Revolution. And one after another, American historians were saying, you know, the Revolutionary War, the war against Britain, should never have happened. There was no reason for it to happen. I have some quotes from a book written by an American called The Radicalism of the American Revolution by Gordon Wood, who's a professor of history at Brown University. He wrote this book in 1991. He shows from historical records that in the 1760s, prior to the rebellion against Britain in 1776, that Americans were more loyal to the king than the British were. This is in the 1760s. Give you some examples here. Well, it says, whatever sense of unity the disparate colonies of North America had came from their common tie to the British crown and from their membership in the British Empire. Most colonists knew more about events in London than they did about occurrences in neighboring colonies, later states. It says, Englishmen everywhere simply made poor subjects for monarchy, and they were proud of it. The English were always a rebellious people, and the Americans continued that tradition, improving upon it. Since the early 17th century, the English had radically transformed their monarchy. They had executed one king and deposed another, written charters and bills of rights, regulated the meetings of their parliaments, and even created a new line of hereditary succession. In the years following the Revolution of 1688, they had become increasingly aware of the marvelous peculiarity of their limited monarchy. It says here that the Constitution of Britain was a constitution especially dedicated to liberty. Liberty, Englishmen everywhere, including Americans who considered themselves Englishmen in the 1760s, Englishmen everywhere of every social rank and of every political persuasion could not celebrate liberty enough. It is not surprising that foreigners thought the English were mad for equality. European visitors from across the Channel thought that ordinary Englishmen had no respect for authority. Common people hooted at their social superiors in the streets and jeered at social pretensions everywhere. It talks about religious freedom. Americans may have had a multiplicity of religious groups and a consequent reputation for religious toleration, but so did the mother country. America had 30 churches operating at the time, so did England in the 1760s and 1770s. Voltaire wrote this in his philosophical letters. If there were only one religion in England, we should have to fear despotism. If there were two, they would cut each other's throats. But there are 30, and they live in peace and happiness. Applies today, I think, too. Englishmen on both sides of the Atlantic bragged of their independence. It mentions that because the growth of royal authority and influence in America was such a recent and novel development, the colonists in the mid-18th century could at times be more enthusiastic monarchists than the English themselves. Certainly, the colonists' excitement over the accession of George III in 1760 equaled that of Englishmen at home. William Henry Drayton of South Carolina thought that no people were ever, quote, more wrapped up in a king than were Americans in 1763. And yet 12 years later, one third of the American people wanted to get rid of the same king, George III. About a third wanted to keep the king, and the other third couldn't spell king. There's always quite a few people who don't know what's going on in any political controversy that might go on anywhere in the world. But it's interesting because in order to fulfill prophecies that we have looked at, America had to break away from Britain, because what unified the multitude of nations, as David said in the previous presentation, what unified the nations of the Commonwealth more than anything was the crown. So America had to separate from that and become a republic in order to be a separate nation. But, as I said, historians can't understand why it happened, because it should never have happened. In every revolution you look at, there are always very good social reasons why the revolution took place. That the people are poor and their leaders are rich. You know, Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. You know, the French Revolution. That's the kind of thing that you see in every revolution. That was not there in the American Revolution, because the Americans were actually better off than the people who ruled over them. So it didn't apply. It had to happen, though, in order to fulfill prophecy. And not only to fulfill prophecy in the context of the greatest single nation being separate from the multitude of nations, but also because Britain might never have gotten the idea of the Commonwealth if the United States had not broken away. Because Britain had to find a way in which those people who wanted to remain under the crown could do so and still receive independence. So when the Canadians in the 1860s, at a time when America to the south was involved in a civil war, and most people thought America would not survive, you know, republics historically have never lasted very long. The Roman Republic lasted 200 years, the Dutch Republic about 300 years. Republics don't last very long, and a lot of people thought that the United States would not survive the civil war in the 1860s. But the Canadians took the opportunity, while the Americans were preoccupied with their own internal problems, to ask the British government for independence. But they made it clear to the British government that they did not want a republic. They wanted to come under the crown still. And so, you know, discussions were held, which led, ultimately, to the establishment of the Dominion of Canada. The word dominion, by the way, comes from Psalm 72. Psalm 72 and verse 8. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. Canada is from sea to sea, from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And the word dominion was taken from this particular passage of Scripture. And Canada became a dominion in 1867, later followed by Australia in 1901, then New Zealand, then the Union of South Africa, then the Irish Free State. They were dominions. Eventually, in 1931, under the Statute of Westminster, they became completely independent countries with their own foreign policies, united solely by the crown. It was a unifying symbol. With the present dynasty in place by 1714, well in time to provide the political stability which has been unique to the British world for almost 300 years, there is no other nation like it on earth in that sense, no other major nation, I should say. You think about the other major powers. The United States since 1714. 1714 was when the House of Windsor, the present Royal House, which back then was called the House of Hanover, came into office, so to speak. And so there's been almost 300 years of political stability. You look at other countries. The United States in that time has had two civil wars. The Revolutionary War was a civil war because there were loyalists and there were those who wanted to separate from Britain. Then there was the civil war between North and South. You could count as well the various wars between the Native Americans and the European settlers. You look at other countries. France had revolution in 1789, anarchy, dictatorship. Then it had the empire with all its abuses. Later on, the monarchy was restored, didn't last very long, so another monarch was brought in, that didn't last very long. There was a military dictatorship, then another empire. Then they tried a third attempt at a republic, which didn't last very long either. And then they had Vichy France, then the Fourth Republic, now the Fifth Republic. Is there any wonder that France could not have been the dominant power in the world in the 1800s and the 1900s with so much political instability? You look at Russia. Very stable for over 300 years under the Romanovs. And then in 1917, the Romanov dynasty collapsed. It had a couple of revolutions in 1 year, a civil war, communism, from which it may never recover. It still has not got a political system that works. China in this century has had revolutions, civil wars, foreign invasion. Germany, disunited until 1870. Then militaristic, leading to defeat in World War I, revolution, the unstable Weimar Republic, Hitler, division. You see, none of the other great powers has had the stability that Britain has had because of its political system. A constitutional monarchy enabled democracy to flourish with basic freedoms for people in all the territories of the empire, because every single territory of the empire had its own parliament except British Somaliland and Hong Kong until more recently. So British Somaliland, what happened? The light here. British Somaliland is that stretch just there. Britain didn't have it very long anyway, and they never had were given a parliament. But Ghana, for example, where my wife and I lived for many years, this light keeps on disappearing. Where's Ghana? Okay, there we go. Ghana had a parliament started about 1860, and Africans were in the parliament as well as Europeans who dominated the country economically at that time. You had parliaments everywhere. So, you know, people basically ruled themselves, but they were held together by loyalty to the crown, by trade to a certain extent, but not in every case, because Canada always did more trade with America than with England. So there was no reason whatsoever for Canada to want to remain within the British Commonwealth. All logic would say it should have just become a part of the United States of America, but it never did. And then, of course, they were held together also by the Royal Navy to a great extent. We'll come to that later on. But we saw how in Genesis 12 it talks about how Abraham's descendants, and in this sense the tribe of Joseph, would be a blessing to the world. The first blessing then was political stability. I'll show you tomorrow when I talk about decolonization, which I have lived through, so I speak from great personal experience in that area, how unstable so many countries that have been given independence have been in the past 40 years. Security was the second blessing. The various nations around the globe that constituted the empire enabled the Royal Navy to dock and replenish, giving it an edge over other navies, which were smaller anyway. The Royal Navy was the biggest navy in the world until 1920, when finally a treaty was signed with America that permitted the Americans to build a navy as big as the British Navy. Disraeli, a British Prime Minister in the 1800s, made it clear that if any British subject, regardless of color, regardless of place of birth, suffered injustice at the hands of a foreign power, he or she had the full might of the Royal Navy behind them. There was an example of somebody, I think, from Cyprus who was in trouble with the Greek government, and the British thought that it was unjustified. The man had never been in England. But because he was a Cypriot and Cyprus was a British territory, the British bombarded Athens until Greece handed him back. And that was the practice of the empire right up until World War I. Of course, another blessing was freedom. They were already the freest people in the world, but became even freer as the 1800s progressed. 1807 saw the abolition of the slave trade, and this is very interesting. The Royal Navy now had authority to stop ships on the high seas and search them for slaves, freeing them. And this is one reason why Britain and America went to war in 1812, because the Americans didn't like the Royal Navy stopping their ships and letting the slaves go free. Now, there's an amazing coincidence took place. We're thinking here of the birthright promises to the tribe of Joseph, Ephraim to become the multitude of nations. In 1833, the British Parliament abolished slavery throughout the empire. All British territories were given 4 years, a four-year transition period, where every slave owner had to prepare his slaves to be, teach them, in other words, how to take care of themselves. Prepare them for that moment when they would be freed. Because it took a long time back then, before the age of telephones and television and everything, for word to spread, the 4 years really began at the beginning of 1834 and ended at the beginning of 1838. Just as the news of Queen Victoria's ascension to the throne was reaching the same territories in the various parts of the world. She had actually become queen a few months earlier, but again, news very slowly back then. So Victoria, a young woman, 18 when she became queen, was seen throughout the world as a liberator because these two events coincided. She was seen as a liberator everywhere around the world. There are more places in the world named after Victoria than anybody else who's ever lived in history. As you know, the state of Victoria right next door. But even in Africa, there's lots of places named after Victoria. Victoria Falls comes immediately to mind. So Victoria was seen as a liberator. There's a very interesting thing I can tell you here. I mentioned that I live 5 hours from Niagara Falls. I live in Michigan, which is in the United States. And one of the places that I sometimes visit when I go over to Niagara Falls is a home in rural Ontario, which was occupied by a man whose name was Josiah Henson. I'm not sure if I'm spelling his name correct when I say H-E-N-S-O-N, but certainly Josiah was his first name, and it was something like Henson was his last name. He was the inspiration for Harriet Beecher Stowe when she wrote the book Uncle Tom's Cabin. Uncle Tom's Cabin, as you know, was about an African-American slave. It's a book which Abraham Lincoln attributed the book to causing the Civil War. When he was visited by Harriet Beecher Stowe in the White House during the war, he said, "So you're the little lady who started this big war." Because the book changed a lot of people's thinking on slavery. But she had seen Josiah Henson. She hadn't met him, but she had seen him. She knew a little bit of him. Josiah Henson, as an American slave, wanted to escape to the freedom of the British Empire. And he did that in the 1840s, I believe it was. He fled across the various states on the Underground Railroad, as it was called, and ended up in the British Empire, where he was now a free man. And on his tomb is a crown of Queen Victoria, which he willed to be placed there. And in the church where he worshipped, he hung a photograph of four generations of monarchs, Queen Victoria, Edward VII, George V, and Edward VIII, taken in 1898, 1899, around there, when all four of them were alive. And this man was immensely loyal to the British Empire, because to him, the empire gave him freedom. That was true in many parts of Africa. I want to read to you a quote from the book Pax Britannica by James Morris. "The Douala chiefs of the Cameroons in West Africa repeatedly asked to be annexed, but the British either declined or took no notice at all. There were territories all over Africa asking the British to come in and rule them, to protect them. Hence the term protectorates. The Ashanti Kingdom, for example, in Ghana was a protectorate. Basutoland was a protectorate. Swaziland, Bechuanaland, they were all protectorates. They wanted Britain to protect them from rival European nations that still practiced slavery. During Victoria's reign of 64 years, the British Empire expanded at a daily rate of 1 mile per day for 64 years. And again, it was largely due to the fact that Britain was seen, and Victoria personally, although she was not the one who had anything to do with the abolition of slavery, but she was seen as the one who was the liberator. The King of Basutoland wrote Queen Victoria that, "My country is your blanket and my people are lice upon it." I mean, these are the kind of letters that you see African chiefs writing at that time in asking for protection, submitting themselves to the Queen Empress and wanting to be looked after and protected from the ravages of the slave trade and some of the other things that they were suffering as well. Even as recently as the 1940s, this perception of Britain endured. When I lived in what was then southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, I remember an African man that I knew extremely well, who was telling me that when he was young, his father had heard that the king and queen would be coming to the country. It was a tour of the empire after World War II to thank people for their loyalty during the war in 1947. And when the father heard that the king and queen were coming, he got all his family together, his wife and 10 children, and they marched for 10 days to the city of Bulawayo, which was the second biggest city in southern Rhodesia, carrying the father carrying a live goat around his neck as an offering to be presented to, and I quote, the great white chief who rules the world. This was said to me in 1975, 76. The perception still had not gone completely by that time. Now, I'm saying these things because we need to understand the mindset in the 1900s, and even in the 1800s, especially the 1800s, I should say, that enabled these blessings to be given to the descendants of Joseph. And of course, today it's fashionable to make fun of colonialism and to attack the colonialists, etc. But, you know, you talk to older people in what was the colonies, and that was not their feeling at all. I picked up a book at a library here on Friday, which I might read a little bit from tomorrow, about the contribution of Commonwealth nations to the war effort in World War II. And just reading some of the quotes from peoples in the various colonies, and I'm talking here about Africans and Asians primarily, their loyalty to the British Empire was incredible. I remember a series made for Channel 4 on Britain, which is the Marxist channel, at least that's the way it's referred to by a lot of people. Channel 4 is the most liberal left-wing TV station. They made a series called End of Empire. And the person who made it was a Marxist historian, so very much against the British Empire. And yet, he couldn't find people who had lived within the empire, the subject peoples, who would attack it, who would criticize it. And the opening line, I still remember, in the first episode of End of Empire, was of an Indian man who lived in Singapore, who said that when we were growing up in the 1920s, he said, our father, every night, made us get down on our knees and thank God that we were born in the British Empire. That was 1920-something. The fourth blessing that was brought was law, an independent judiciary. On the continent, the king was above the law. It is interesting that in Britain and America, that principle, the principle has been since Magna Carta in 1215, right up until Bill Clinton in 1999, that the king was not above the law. I'm serious. This was a turning point, I think, in the American legal process, because basically what we've seen in the last few months was that the president is above the law, at least in terms of his likelihood of being prosecuted. But anyway, from 1215, when Magna Carta was signed, everybody, including the king, was subject to the law. You remember the story of how King David in ancient Israel, in wanting to commit adultery with Bathsheba, had her husband killed. And afterwards, Nathan the prophet came to him and corrected him. You know, that is inconceivable in an absolute monarchy, that anybody would come and say those things to the monarch. In ancient Israel, there was a primitive form of checks and balances. Maybe not even primitive. The king had a great deal of power, but so did the high priest. And the high priest could correct the king. And so you had a system of checks and balances, and it seems that that's been handed down. England has never had an absolute monarchy, maybe a little bit with the Normans when they invaded in 1066, but even before that, the king had a parliament called the Witan, which advised him on matters. So it wasn't an absolute monarchy. The only time England has ever been led by one man was under the English Republic, Oliver Cromwell. He ended up as a dictator, which is why the English decided they never wanted to be a republic again, and why when the Americans started agitating for independence over 100 years later, many Americans did not want to go down that route either, because they remembered England's experience of republic. They'd read of it in the 1600s. The fifth blessing, freedom of religion. General respect for the beliefs of others. I can only think, I mean, somebody else might be able to add something here. I can only think of two religious customs that the British in all their colonies changed by legislation. Only two. One was suti in India, which was the custom whereby when a man died, his wife, even if she might only be 18, had to, you know, kill herself with a knife on top of his funeral pyre as the flames were roaring around her. She had to die with him. The British banned that. They also banned the custom of thuggee, which is where we get the word thug from. because Hindu followers in this extreme sect were murdering people in order to get, you know, whatever they wanted. It was part of their religious teaching, apparently, their religious belief. And the British banned that as well. But I can't think of any other religious practice that was actually banned. In West Africa, you know, a lot of people were sacrificed to the gods. That stopped when the British took over. I don't think they had to legislate for it. It just kind of stopped. So freedom of religion was definitely very much a blessing. I'll tell you a story of Cecil Rhodes, to whom I'm not related. I wish I was, because he left a lot of money behind. But anyway, Cecil Rhodes, when he was when he was building up the colony that was named after him in Rhodesia, made a visit to it. He was Prime Minister of the Cape in South Africa at the time. And he went up to Bulawayo and saw his friend Dr. Jameson. And as they were going through the city on horseback, he asked what building was being built in a certain area. And Jameson said, it's a synagogue. And Cecil Rhodes' response was, oh, good, he said, if the Jews are coming here, then my colony has a great future. It was interesting, when we were there during the Civil War, the Jews were leaving. And the reverse is also true. You know, Zimbabwe today is a bankrupt dictatorship. So, a reversal. The freedom of religion also, interestingly, you know, gave us the Bible. It was under the English government in 1611, under James I, that the Bible was translated into English. England had broken away from Rome under Henry VIII. Henry VIII, in the 1530s, did not have a male heir, and he blamed his wife for this and wanted to get rid of her. And the Pope wouldn't let him divorce her, so he then decided to break with the Roman Church and start his own church. It's a good enough reason for starting your own church. People have started their own church for all kinds of different reasons. Excuse me. But Henry VIII, anyway, broke with Rome for that reason. And it began a period of religious turmoil, because his eldest daughter, Mary, became queen sometime after he died in 1553. And she married the King of Spain, Philip II, who was the son of Charles V, who you remember was one of the leaders of one of the horns, the resurrections of the Roman Empire that we went through this morning. You can look at your chart to see that. And, you know, Philip II was under instructions from the Pope to bring England back into the Catholic fold. Mary, fortunately, only lived 5 years. She died in 1558. In 1558, her half-sister Elizabeth became queen. And Elizabeth had seen her mother, or not seen, she didn't actually see the execution, but she knew that her mother was beheaded when she was only 2 years of age. She was accused of treason, but the truth is that Henry, by this time, wanted a third wife, so he had his second wife's head cut off, and that was Elizabeth's mother, Anne Boleyn. Elizabeth then was tutored by people who had studied the Bible. They were Protestants. And it was a new movement at that time, Protestants, protesting against the corruption of the Roman Catholic Church. And these Protestants educated Elizabeth, who became a Bible student herself. So out of personal conviction, Elizabeth wanted nothing to do with what was considered by these people the Great Whore, the Catholic Church. Their interpretation of Revelation 17 and so on was that that was what the church was, so they wanted to break away from it. Elizabeth also knew that because her sister Mary, who had recently died, had been married to Philip II of Spain, that Philip II, his most Catholic majesty, Philip II, would at some point try to invade the country and kill her. If any of you have seen the recent movie Elizabeth, you'll know that all kinds of attempts were made to get rid of Elizabeth before she became queen. And Elizabeth was very clever. She kind of half-promised, seemingly, to marry Philip II herself. But at the same time, she was telling the King of France, who was also Catholic, that she would marry him. And she was playing one off against the other, you see, and that way keeping them away. But she also realized the only way to preserve England's freedom of religion was to ensure that England had the biggest navy, the most powerful navy, and for England to look beyond Europe for its trade. And so a great period of exploration began with English explorers going all over the world looking for trade. And so we see the beginning of what later became the British Empire. Elizabeth also did something else, which is very important. Although if you watch the movie, you wouldn't believe it. She remained the Virgin Queen. In order that when she died, her cousin's son, the King of Scotland, would become King of England as well, thereby uniting the two countries. Because Scotland, historically, had often allied itself with France. And the Stuart monarchy was Catholic. Mary, Queen of Scots, you remember, was the mother of James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England. They were Catholics. They were often allied to France. And this meant that England was faced with hostile enemies in two directions, one of whom was actually sharing the same island that England was on. So by making sure that she did not have any children, Elizabeth I did England a great service. She actually united, in that sense, England and Scotland in 1603. And that, again, was a very important foundation stone in the development of the British Empire. I mentioned a scripture in Genesis chapter 49. You might just like to look at it again. It said in verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. The archers have surely grieved him and shot at him and hated him, but his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. This is a reference to the fact in the end times, and Genesis 49 is about the end times. It says in verse 1, in the last days, it's talking about where the sons of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel, would be in the last days prior to Christ's return. And this passage then, in talking about Joseph and all these wars, is interesting. I asked a friend of mine who does work at the University of Michigan. They have a department which is dedicated to what is called peace studies. It sounds rather Orwellian. It's actually a study of wars, to try to find out what causes wars and to try to avoid them in the future. I took a class there myself a few years ago and found it extremely interesting. They have kept data, perfect data, on every conflict since 1815 in every country around the world. When you see the number of times that each country has gone to war, the nation which has gone to war the most since 1815 is Great Britain. 66 times. The next highest was France, 56 times. The United States was at number 20. Sorry, the United States was 20 times, I'm sorry. I think in position number 6. But you see, Britain during the period of the Pax Britannica, and even during this century, has had to preserve the freedom, not only of the British themselves, but of course the Empire as well. And that has meant, many wars, even down to just a few weeks ago in the Balkans. And I think, it's interesting to look at that. And of course, Australia was a part of that system, the multitude of nations. It wasn't just Great Britain. This is something that people tend to forget. When we talk about the British Empire, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, the people considered themselves as British as Britain itself was. And so we were all a part of a superpower, which is what it was, a superpower, right up until the Second World War. The Second World War ultimately destroyed that superpower, and then it was replaced by the United States in terms of world domination. So where does the British Empire fit in the chart that I showed you this morning? I should mention, by the way, with that chart, where it says the seven church-state resurrections of the Roman Empire, number 7 is not on there, because it's still in the future. So if that's a little bit unclear, I'm sorry about that, but I just list 6 there right up until now, but there's still one more to come. And that answers the question, where does the British Empire fit into this? Look at Revelation chapter 17 and verse 10. I just want to speculate a little bit here for 2 minutes, if you will bear with me. There are 7 kings, 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. We already saw this morning that this final 7th king, this resurrection of the Roman Empire, a continuation, in effect, of the Roman Empire, leads right into the return of Jesus Christ. So we know it's got to come back. Where does Britain fit in this? Well, 5 are fallen. The first 5 are Justinian, remember, in 554, Charlemagne in 800, the Holy Roman Empire beginning in the 960s, and then you had Charles the Fifth, the Habsburg Charles, Emperor, Napoleon, that was 5. Then you had a period of British and later American ascendancy, during which this book has been exported around the world. During which also, and really only since about 1870, we have seen a gradual increase in the number of literate people in the world. Free education, universal literacy within the English-speaking world, only really came about in the 1870s. In 1867, every man got the vote in Britain, and one of the first things they insisted upon was education for their children. So most people in Britain, Australia, New Zealand, America, could not read this until about 100 years. So is it possible that's an explanation of the phrase, one is? Because these passages were not read, really, for centuries, except by a few priests who might have understood them and understood how to read, but not understood what the words meant. But it says, five are fallen, one is. The one that is, one. The sixth one, the second and third Reichs, from 1870 till 1945. And then one is still to come. The British Empire fits in right there after the fifth resurrection, Napoleon, who was defeated at Waterloo by the British in 1815, and right through until the First World War, when that sixth resurrection of the Roman Empire triggered off a conflict, which became an even bigger threat to our freedoms the second time around in 1939. And that's where the multitude of nations fits in. And like I said, we've all lived through a period of British and American domination. We don't remember being dominated by any other nation, but the Bible shows us that we're going to go back to a period very similar to that. I just want to read to you in closing a passage from Pax Britannica, a book by James Morris, which is written about the events of 1897, when the empire was at its climax. In 1897, Queen Victoria had been on the throne for 60 years. And there was a great celebration at her Diamond Jubilee. And the whole book is built around this celebration. It was the largest empire in the history of the world, comprising nearly a quarter of the landmass of the earth and a quarter of its population. Victoria herself was a queen empress of such aged majesty that some of her simpler subjects considered her divine and slaughtered propitiatory goats before her image. Remember that story from Southern Rhodesia. The 60th anniversary of her accession to the throne was being celebrated as a festival of imperial strength, splendor, and unity, a mammoth exhibition of power in a capital that loved things to be colossal. The crowds outside waited in proud excitement. They were citizens of a kingdom which, particularly in its own estimation, was of unique consequence in the world. The 19th century had been preeminently Britain's century, and the British saw themselves still as top dogs. Ever since the triumphant conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars, they had seemed to be arbiters of the world's affairs, righting a balance here, dismissing a potentate there, ringing the earth with railways and submarine cables, lending money everywhere, peopling the empty places with men of the British stock. Genesis 49:22, Joseph shall be a fruitful bough. Grandly revenging wrongs, converting pagans, discovering unknown lakes, setting up dynasties, emancipating slaves, winning wars, putting down mutinies, keeping Turks in their place, and building bigger and better battleships. By June 1897, all this vigor and self-esteem, all this famous history, had been fused into an explosive emotional force. The nation had been carried away by the enthusiasm known as the New Imperialism, an expansionist, sensational concept of empire which exactly fitted the spirit of the 90s. The empire had been growing steadily throughout the century, generally without much public excitement. But since the 1870s, it had expanded so quickly that the statistics and reference books and the maps could not keep up and were full of addenda and hasty footnotes. It was expanding so quickly towards the end of the 19th century. There's another quote I want to read to you because it gives you some of the praise of other nations to Queen Victoria or in their newspapers on the day that Victoria had this celebration of her 60th anniversary to the throne. Le Figaro, the French newspaper, roundly declared that Rome itself had been equaled, if not surpassed, by the power which in Canada, Australia, India, in the China Seas, in Egypt, Central and Southern Africa, in the Atlantic and in the Mediterranean, rules the people and governs their interests. The New York Times, in the former British colonies that had become a republic, claimed, "We are a part, America is a part, and a great part of the Greater Britain, which seems so plainly destined to dominate this planet." Even the Kreuz Zeitung in Berlin, the paper of the Prussian militarists under the Kaiser, even this newspaper described the empire as practically unassailable. Everywhere, in paying their respects to the Queen, the nations appear to be paying homage to Britain. There's another quote as well from another newspaper I want to read to you. "History may be searched, and searched in vain, to discover so wonderful an exhibition of allegiance and brotherhood amongst so many myriads of men. The mightiest and most beneficial empire ever known in the annals of mankind." There were other quotes about the actual parades and how you had troops from all over the different countries. You know, you had Gurkhas, you had Indians, you had Pakistanis, or they weren't called Pakistanis back then, but you had Australians and South Africans and so on in the parades from all over the world. And it was a great celebration of British power at that time. Well, of course, it all came to an end, and decolonization took over, and I want to talk about that tomorrow and tie that in with what the Bible has to say as well, so we understand even more where we are now at this time in history. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer the questions. If you don't have any questions, it means I must have said everything. So, okay, good.
All I can say is please take advantage of our speakers. But if you don't have a question there, sir?
Does somebody have a question?
I was to say this at Easter, Jesus.
Sorry.
Yeah, my Bible.
You can write down the question.
Yeah.
A bit hard to understand what David's trying to say sometimes, yeah. But...
Can you translate or do you know what he wants?
I quite understand that one.
Okay, look, I'm sorry, we're sort of missing that one.
Okay, is there any other questions? Okay, see you tomorrow morning.
Ladies and gentlemen. Well, I hope that you've found those two presentations to be worthwhile. I certainly enjoyed them. Throwing a interesting, different perspective and different life light on the history of Israel, I guess. We can summarise it that way. Can I invite you to stay around? We have tea, coffee up the back. We have some booklets and some presentations there on the stands. If you can remember to maybe fill in the survey and the questionnaire, we'd really appreciate that. And we'd love to see you again tomorrow. Remember, 11 o'clock we start. And again, we'll be going for the whole day with a morning and afternoon session. So to continue the presentations that started this afternoon. So thank you very much for your participation, and we'll see you tomorrow.